Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. John McCall approached the slight man in the boarding house with bemusement. Here was a guy wearing top-shelf clothing in a room filled with far more of the stuff, yet he was clearly struggling financially. Why else would he be running such a cheap room? McCall was no dummy. In fact, he was a Montreal police detective, and he'd arrived at the boarding house thanks to some astute sleuthing and a few useful tips. He thought he had a pretty good idea as to why the boarding room renter seemed both poor and rich at the same time. After greeting the boarder, who was almost impressively small, standing 5'2" and weighing 120-some pounds, McCall asked a question. "Is your name Bianchi? Carlos Bianchi?" "Why no," the boarder replied. "My name's Clement." That's when McCall identified himself as law enforcement. Bianchi slash Clement didn't wait for him to say anything else, instead blurting, "I'm guilty." Turned out, the boarder had earlier in the week waltzed into a shipping firm called the Canadian Warehousing Company, spotted a checkbook on someone's desk, and, when no one was looking, tore out a blank check and walked away. Soon after, he had filled in the blanks with the oddly specific amount of $423.58, then went to the bank of Hochelaga and signed the check D. Fournier. The teller handed him 42 $10 bills, three singles, and the rest in coins. Then the boarder went on a spending spree. Now, this happened in late summer of 1908. So $400 and change in a spending spree went a lot further than it would today. The boarder bought two high-end suits, an overcoat, several dress shirts, collars, cuffs, ties, a pair of boots, and a watch and chain. Even after buying all of that, he still had nearly $220 left. His plan had been to leave Montreal and head back to America. But as he was packing, the Hochelaga bank folk got suspicious about the check they had cashed and compared known signatures of their customer, D. Fournier. The signatures didn't match, so McCall was sent searching for the forger. He found him at the boarding house. Despite having straight up told the detective, "I'm guilty," the boarder pleaded innocent to no avail. He was found guilty of forgery and sentenced to 3 years in prison. By then, it was known that his name was neither Bianchi, as McCall had believed, or Clement, as the accused had claimed. His real name would, in a few years' time, become synonymous with a specific type of scam, one far more nuanced and financially devastating than the mere forging of checks. As the world would soon learn, his name was Ponzi, and he had a scheme. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Field of Greens. As I am recording this, I literally have a bottle of Field of Greens next to me because it's mid-afternoon, I'm feeling a bit of a slump coming on, and this stuff gives me a little boost. I add one scoop of Field of Greens to my water, and through that, I get a full serving of vegetables and a full serving of fruit. It feels like the healthiest thing I do for myself, and it tastes great. I've tried three flavors so far, the original, the strawberry lemonade, and the wild berry, and I have no notes. Here's what I noticed since taking Field of Greens. I feel like it helps with digestion. I haven't been napping as much during the day, and I generally feel like my skin looks healthier. Now, I talked with a company rep recently, and she told me that Field of Greens is different from similar seeming products because it's made with real USDA organic fruits and veggies, not extracts, which means it has a nutrition label on it like food has. It's not a supplement. And each organic fruit and vegetable used in the products were medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I think you're going to love this product, but if for any reason you don't, they'll give you a 100% money-back guarantee. I got you 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code COTC. That's promo code COTC at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Charles Ponzi came into the world March 3rd, 1882, in Lugo, Italy, as Carlo Pietro Giovanni Guglielmo Tibaldo Ponzi. It was a mouthful of a name, and to honor both his maternal and paternal grandfathers, who sired Carlos's parents, Oreste and Imelda Ponzi. Oreste's side of the family had been middle class, the men working as tradesmen and hoteliers. Oreste himself worked as a postman. Imelda Ponzi, on the other hand, came from aristocracy. From a video by Patrick Boyle on finance.
All of his mother's family had Don or Donna in front of their names, which tied them to the Duchy of Parma. So they were Italian aristocrats, but by the time Charles was born, the money was all gone.
Well, the legacy money was gone anyway. Carlos still grew up relatively comfortably, allowing his parents to dote on their only son. His mother especially prepped Carlo for greatness, insisting that she and her husband send the boy to a private boarding school, one that had been founded by Napoleon's second wife, Princess Marie Louise. Carlo was a bright and personable student, well-liked by the nuns who taught him. He earned good grades and excelled especially in languages, becoming fluent in French in addition to his native Italian. Carlo's mother imagined him becoming a judge or a lawyer, something more profitable than her husband's job as a postal worker, which again, paid just fine. Imelda simply wanted more. What mother doesn't, right? Sending Carlo away to boarding school was thought to be for his own good, of course, but the truth was Carlo felt lonely and a bit abandoned at times. That wasn't eased by his father's death while he was away, wrote Mitchell Zukov in the book Ponzi's Scheme. After Oreste died, Carlo inherited a bit of money. Adding that to some money also left to him by an aunt, Carlo had enough to attend university, which is a big enough deal today, but was far bigger at the time.
It's worth noting that at the time, less than 5% of the population attended university at all.
By comparison, today about 38% of Americans aged 25 and older have bachelor's degrees, according to the Census Bureau. Carlo thrilled his mother by gaining acceptance to the University of Rome, the city's oldest university, founded 6 centuries earlier. When she got updates from her son, they were inevitably brag-worthy. He was learning so much and doing so well in his classes. She was certain her dreams for his success were destined to come true. Trouble was, though, that Carlo wasn't doing well at all. Instead of using his respectable inheritance in a respectable way, he gravitated toward a group of rich students who spent their family's real fortunes on nonsense, because, you know, they had lots more money where that came from. Carlo, on the other hand, did not. He adopted his friends' rich kid styles and spending habits, but had nothing replenishing his coffer, which maybe wouldn't have been so bad, but the guy didn't even bother going to classes either. He'd sleep all day, then get up late to hit some cafes, maybe a restaurant, perhaps catch an opera at the theater. Around midnight, he'd hit the casinos, where he'd often lose his shirt. This all inevitably caught up with him. He washed out of university and left Rome. After that debacle, an uncle suggested something that Carlo apparently hadn't thought of before. He said that maybe Carlo should get a job. Like an entry-level clerk somewhere, nothing too dirty or menial. Carlo was, after all, somewhat respectably educated, even if his university stint had been a disaster. But Carlo said no way. He hadn't worked a day in his life, and he wasn't keen to start now. As Mitchell Zukov wrote, quote, "The uncle tried a different tack, saying, 'Poor, uneducated Italian boys go to America and make lots of money. You have a good education, you're refined and of a good family, you should be able to make a fortune in America easily.'" End quote. Then the uncle supposedly said that the streets in the United States were actually paved with gold. Quote, "All you have to do is stoop and pick it up." End quote. I've heard this saying before and always assumed it was known even to the most naive of immigrants to be a turn of phrase. But then again, this came after the gold rush in California, so who knows what Carlo expected. Whatever the case, he managed to get another $220 from his family to fund his way on a 2-week voyage to the New World. He promised his mother that this time he would live up to his potential. He would make her proud. He bought a second-class ticket aboard the SS Vancouver, though he would later insist he'd gone first class, and climbed aboard the vessel on November 3, 1903. Before he had even made it to New York, he had gambled away nearly all of the money his family had given him. He seriously had like $2.50 left. Luckily, his mother had had enough foresight to provide him prepaid train fare from New York to Pittsburgh, where he was able to live with some distant relative he had never met before. Before he even got there, though, he was starting to think this whole come to America to find your fortune business had been total bullshit. I don't know if he really thought there'd be gold lining the streets, but it seemed he hadn't been expecting the mud and grime that did greet him. His first weeks were especially tough because he didn't know any English, and at one point he nearly got arrested because he slammed into a police officer while running around trying to figure out how to find food to eat. Finally, to assuage his growling belly, he did the unthinkable. He got a job. More than one, in fact. From a History Channel documentary.
Over the next few years, Ponzi would try his hand at nearly everything he could, moving from grocery clerk to sewing machine repairman to insurance salesman. At one time, he began a job as a dishwasher in a restaurant, sleeping on the floor at night because he had nowhere else to stay.
He tended to impress his employers at first. He adopted the anglicized name Charles, becoming Charles Ponzi. He learned English quickly, he was kind to customers, he seemed diligent and hardworking. But he always ended up in some kind of trouble, usually of the thieving variety.
As he moved all over the East Coast of the United States, from Pittsburgh to New York to New Haven to Providence, he would stay in these cities for an extended amount of time before he became too well known for his misdeeds, and eventually had to move on to the next place.
Maybe America wasn't his land of opportunity after all. Maybe it was Canada. North America had seen an influx of Italian immigrants around the turn of the century, and while lots of businesses banned them altogether, even putting up Italians need not apply signs in their storefronts, one Montreal outfit had a different idea.
A bank there had been started by Luigi Zarassi in order to serve the influx of Italian immigrants that were arriving to the city.
It was appropriately called Banco Zarassi. Charles Ponzi arrived there in July 1907, and, despite having no prior banking experience, he impressed Zarassi enough to be hired as a clerk. Ponzi was thrilled, which author Mitchell Zuckoff noted in his book was kind of funny when you remember that the whole reason Ponzi had come to America was to avoid accepting his uncle's advice and applying to be a clerk somewhere back in Italy. But whatever. It should be noted that Zarassi barely had more banking experience than Ponzi. The bank owner had previously been in the cigar business. As soon as he entered the world of finance, he decided his focus would be to destroy his competition, which he set about doing by offering crazy high percentage rates on his customers' accounts. See, other banks offered about 3% interest. Zarassi said, "Hey, I can do double that." While his competitors balked, saying that kind of profit margin was impossible, Zarassi seemed to deliver. People who deposited their funds into his bank withdrew at the promised 6% interest rate, meaning that they made twice as much on their stagnant money than they would have at a bank down the street. Ponzi apparently was fascinated by this, and as he climbed the employment ladder, first becoming a teller and then a bank manager, he paid attention.
Then, he found out that the bank was in serious financial trouble because of some bad real estate loans it had made. More importantly, the bank owner had been funding the extreme interest payments not through profits on investments, but by using the money deposited in newly opened accounts. The more money that came in, the more the bank was able to offer as an interest rate, making it more appealing to new customers.
As you can probably guess, this eventually became a problem. Enough people asked for their money back in a short enough window of time that Zarassi didn't have the dough to cover the demand. So he did what any respectable businessman would do. He left his wife and daughters and hauled ass out of town. In the aftermath, one bank employee disappeared and another killed himself. Ponzi stayed put for months, keeping a watch over Zarassi's family for a while. It no doubt helped that Ponzi was a little sweet on one of his former boss's daughters, but eventually Ponzi must have gotten restless because that's when he stole a blank check, forged it, and got himself sentenced to 3 years in Canadian prison. His mother had no idea.
Not wanting his family in Italy to learn the real story, the enterprising Ponzi wrote to his beloved mother that he had taken a job as special assistant to the prison warden for 3 years.
This almost turned out true in a way. The guards and warden at the prison found Ponzi just as charming as his former employers had initially, so he was given plum assignments during his months behind bars, plus an early release. After 20 months, he was a free man, and so he headed back to America, where he promptly got into trouble again. This time, his plan had been to make a quick buck helping to smuggle Italian immigrants across the border from Canada to the United States. That landed him a 2-year prison term at a penitentiary in Georgia. Once he was released in 1918, he made his way back to Boston. For a short stint, Ponzi went straight. He got a job at an importer-exporter called J.R. Poole and again proved himself a good enough worker that he fairly quickly climbed the corporate ladder. The pay was mediocre, starting at about $16 a week. With his promotions, however, he reached $25 a week, which translates to about $1,550 in today's money, or not quite $19,000 annually. It wasn't great. What made things worse, though, was the fact that Ponzi's changing responsibilities meant that he oversaw how his own boss, John R. Poole, spent his money, and seeing that enormous amount compared to Ponzi's piddly salary made him all the more bitter. As Ponzi later wrote, quote, "By starving one day and eating a little less the next one, we employees always managed, more or less, to keep handsomely in debt," end quote. Then Ponzi finally got lucky. His supervisor died, which meant he was promoted to a gig that paid $50 a week. This emboldened him to marry a woman on whom he'd been sweet. Rose Nico said yes, and the two wed February 4th, 1918. Not long after that, Ponzi was hit with what you might call his Eureka idea. It went like this. Beginning in 1906, people writing letters to loved ones or business acquaintances overseas could buy an international reply coupon to include in said letter that the recipient could then exchange for postage in their country. It was sort of like including a self-addressed stamped envelope, except it didn't include the envelope, only the stamp. And it was less convenient than that because you had to swap out the coupon included to actually get the real stamp, but still. It was a nice thing to include in overseas communications because it essentially prepaid for the recipient's response. Ponzi knew this, of course, because he wrote home often to his mother in Italy. He also knew that because Europe had been essentially flattened by World War I, the exchange rate was likely to work in his favor in America for quite a while to come.
Ponzi realized that if you went to a European post office with American dollars and bought postal reply coupons, and then brought them to this country and cashed them in, you got U.S. postage many times more valuable than the U.S. money you spent.
It kind of sounds illegal, but it wasn't then and isn't now. It's called arbitrage, or the simultaneous buying and selling of securities, currency, or commodities in different markets in order to take advantage of different prices for the same asset. Thanks, study.com. Here's another take from Magnates Media.
Arbitrage was a sound investment tactic that had been in use for centuries.
With this idea in his noggin, Ponzi in January 1920 created a new company called the Securities Exchange Company. It's worth noting that there was no Securities and Exchange Commission until 1933. Ponzi pitched his IRC business idea to banks, hoping for loans, but none bit. So he pitched instead straight to some investors with whom he had far more luck. Because on paper, his idea made sense. He figured he could buy $1 worth of IRCs in, say, Spain, bring them back home, and exchange them for around $1.10 in stamps back here. And that's a 10% profit. Swap Spain for Italy, where the lira had suffered far worse than the peseta, and Ponzi could make more like a 30% profit. In theory, anyway. What Ponzi didn't mention to his eager investors was that he hadn't figured out a few crucial details, like how to keep those profit margins while also employing people to do the buys in Europe, send the IRCs to America, and then make the exchange here. Even worse, the IRCs weren't actually redeemable for dollars. You could only buy stamps with them. So even if Ponzi figured out how to get the assembly line working, he still would have to find a way to translate those coupons to cash.
The truth was that the profits from the arbitrage of IRCs were so small that they would be completely wiped out by the cost of shipping the IRCs from one country to another. There literally were not enough IRCs in the entire world to sustain the kind of operation that Ponzi was imagining, and yet he refused to let go of this idea.
He didn't mention the obstacles he faced to investors, and most investors didn't ask. Those who did quickly stopped caring once they heard Ponzi's promise. Whatever money you give me today, I'll give you 50% more in 45 days' time. The early investors saw those returns, convincing the early skeptics to fork over their dough. Within a few short months, Charles Ponzi was a millionaire. Crimes of Centuries is sponsored by Hiya Health Products. I've seen other moms whose kids eat everything, but that is not the case with my 10-year-old. So of course I try to fill in the gaps for him with a good vitamin, but I swear the typical children's vitamins are basically candy. Hiya fills in the most common gaps in modern children's diets to provide the full body nourishment our kids need with a yummy taste they'll love. And they do that while being made with zero sugar and zero gummy junk. Yet my kid still likes how they taste, which is nothing short of a miracle. In fact, I asked my son to give a testimonial. Here's the audio from it.
How's the flavor?
Good.
Hiya is pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others to help support immunity, energy, brain function, mood, concentration, teeth, bones, and more. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. After Charles Ponzi hatched his international reply coupon scheme, he got stupid rich, stupid fast, and he was thrilled to flaunt it. He'd long had a preference for fine European suits, fitted ones, mind you, ones that made his diminutive frame as impressive as possible. He wore fancy cuffs and jaunty caps and twirled a gold-tipped cane. His newly built home was soon filled with fine antiques, which delighted his wife Rose, who began to boast to her friends and family about her financial whiz of a husband. Soon, Rose's relatives were in line to invest with Ponzi too. From the History Channel.
Ponzi happily accepted money from all comers, including $800 from his wife, Rose. By March, more than 100 people had invested almost $30,000. But Ponzi owed these investors more than $45,000 in principal and interest. Fortunately for Ponzi, when the notes came due, most depositors kept their money invested to accrue even more interest.
Those who did opt to cash out were covered, not because Ponzi had done the whole buy IRCs in Europe to sell in America business, but rather because he used money from new investors, or continuing investors, to pay back the departing investors. So if someone who had invested $200 wanted their dough plus interest back in 45 days, they'd get their $300 no problem. This wasn't a scheme Ponzi invented by any means. His old boss at Banco Zerossi had done it by using new bank customers' dough to pay back that 6% interest he'd promised too. And long before that, there were other examples of this scheme as well. Like one launched by Adelheid Louise Spitzeder, a German actress born in 1832 who went by the stage name Adele Vio. In her mid-30s, Adele opened herself a bank that became the talk of the town in Munich, thanks largely to word-of-mouth advertising. Adele said she could earn people 10% interest on their investments and appealed mostly to working class folk, some of whom didn't trust traditional banks. Soon, Adele had some 40 employees working for her, but like her eventual successor Ponzi, everything about her so-called business was a lie. She never invested anyone's money, but rather used most of the funds to afford a lavish lifestyle herself. When people did ask for their money back, she simply dipped into newer investments to prove she was good for it. It took authorities 3 years to shut her down, though because this was the first scheme of its kind documented in modern history, she basically got off with a slap on the wrist, being convicted of simply bad accounting and mishandling customers' money. She was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but the devastation she sowed was immeasurable. When her bank closed, more than 30,000 people lost the modern equivalent of some 400 million euros. According to a 2017 article written in German that I can't read but that I hope was translated properly for me, this triggered a wave of suicides. Some people had entrusted her with their life savings and lost every penny, or gulden, as it were. Decades before Ponzi arrived, newspapers simply used an adage to describe Adele's crime. She robbed Peter to pay Paul. It's hard to say why this didn't become known as the Spitzetter scheme. Adele made international news in her day, so it wasn't for lack of awareness. And she wasn't the only such fraudster to predate Ponzi either. It's anyone's guess why this style of scam wasn't named after Johann Baptist Placht of Vienna, or Sarah Howe of Boston, or William Miller of Brooklyn. Maybe it was because
Ponzi took the idea to a whole new level.
This documentary from Magnates Media is called The Financial Idiot Who Scammed the World. It's a subtle title. Anyway, the Adeles and Johans and Sarahs and such still offered somewhat reasonable interest rates as they were fleecing their clients. We're talking rates in the 10-ish percent range, give or take. By offering 50%, Ponzi really upped the stakes. Plus,
he claimed to have a vast network of agents all over the world who are buying IRCs in bulk and shipping them to America. If pressed for any details on his operation, Ponzi would refuse to divulge any information, simply claiming that he couldn't share all the details of exactly how it worked, as then it could potentially help his competition.
In short, he was brazen, even in the face of skepticism, of which he faced plenty.
Most banks, companies, and serious investors stayed away from Ponzi. They knew when something was too good to be true, and in fact, almost anyone who knew a thing or two about finances could tell that it was impossible for Ponzi to deliver on his promises. But they were not the ones Ponzi targeted. He wanted the people who used to be just like him, with more dreams than common sense, who were always looking for the best way to get rich quick.
What's saddest about that is the Venn diagram of these people with little financial know-how overlapped enormously with people who were in dire financial straits, or if not that, people who at least couldn't afford to lose what they had. Of course, that never seems to worry guys like Charles Ponzi. For a long while, relatively speaking anyway, because this whole ordeal lasted all of about 7 months, Ponzi's business grew simply by word of mouth. People who handed him money got these little vouchers that served as receipts with the amount they'd invested and the date it was set to mature. Peter Boyle again.
Ponzi not only seemed willing and able to pay people back, but he had his bookkeeper send people postcards a few days before their money became due in order to remind them to come in and collect their money. It made him look extremely credible to these people that he seemed to want them to collect their profits.
He could have fled with an obscene amount of money, but he didn't. Maybe he thought he would still figure out a way to turn his IRC plan into real money, though that seems doubtful. When a competitor popped up promising the same returns on the same idea, buying reply coupons overseas to exchange in America, Ponzi didn't worry at all about them figuring out the formula. He just worried that people would get confused and ship their money to the new scam artist rather than to him. More likely, Ponzi just didn't see an end in sight to his good fortunes. He carried a $1 million certificate of deposit in his pocket at all times. He added diamond tie pins to his already flashy attire, and he bought the fanciest car available to him. It was called a locomobile, and it was a custom-built thing of beauty that made the mass-produced Model T look like a Pinto by comparison, which is kind of wild when you consider that you were still in the minority if you scraped together the $300 a Model T cost in 1920. Ponzi's locomobile, meanwhile, cost upwards of $12,000. To make things even more unrelatable, Ponzi didn't drive his fancy car. He had a chauffeur, one who, by the way, had invested a portion of his wages into Ponzi's international reply coupon scheme. Every day, Ponzi's driver would take the millionaire to and from his office on School Street, which often already had a line of people waiting for him in the morning. Things seemed to be going fairly well, except for a small hiccup. Ponzi was sued by one of his earliest investors, a furniture dealer named Joseph Daniels. Daniels had given $200 to Ponzi's company early on and had somehow figured that because his dough had served as seed money for a business now worth millions, he should get a cut. It was a silly lawsuit, really, but it earned a write-up in the Boston Post, a daily newspaper that had been founded in 1831. The story was headlined, "Boston Man is Sued for $1 Million." It didn't go into any depth because Daniels, the suer, was out of town. The piece simply quoted the suee, Charles Ponzi, saying he had no idea why Daniels was suing him in the first place. But while the lawsuit was frivolous, it did manage to freeze some of Ponzi's assets. It also triggered some investors to cash in their investments, but that was no problem for Ponzi. It wasn't a huge tide of cash out, so he could easily handle it. Plus, his ability to make the payments encouraged other people to invest in him even more. In the end, the Daniels suit probably helped make him $1 million, not in total, but per week. An editor at the Post took note of the man who had enough money to be sued for $1 million and assigned a reporter to do a profile on Ponzi. That piece was what we call in the journalism business, fluffy garbage. The headline, "Doubles the Money Within 3 Months." It quoted Ponzi at length without questioning a thing he said. Among those things, he got the coupon idea from a letter mailed to him from Spain. He was quote-unquote university educated. Of 3 Boston police officers assigned to investigate his business, 2 walked away as investors. And he said, quote, "I also had a talk with post office inspectors and with Daniel J. Gallagher, United States District Attorney. They can see nothing illegal in my business," end quote. Now, not everything he said was a lie. It was estimated that at Ponzi's peak, he did, in fact, have police officer investors. Like, a lot of them. The majority of the force. Those kernels of truth helped bolster people's resolve to believe the rest of the story, because as implausible as it all was, people wanted to believe it. The day the story ran in the newspaper, Ponzi's chauffeur drove him to his office and people jammed every crevice of School Street. By the end of that day, Ponzi had tallied up more than $200,000 in new investments just at that one office. He had also launched a couple of satellite offices to boot that did about the same amount of business at each. As much as people love to say all press is good press, that simply isn't the case. The front page Boston Post profile of Charles Ponzi caught the attention of a shrewd publisher in town, who happened to helm the Boston Post. Richard Grozier apparently read the story in his own paper and thought, something doesn't seem right here. He got increasingly concerned when he learned that a lot of Post reporters had given Ponzi money to invest. Grozier had had the kind of upbringing Ponzi wished he'd had, as in Grozier came from actual money. His father Edwin had been the Post publisher before Richard took it over, and his father had been a damn good businessman, buying the newspaper when it was on the absolute brink of failure and building it up to one of the most read, most profitable publications in the country. This is finance guy Patrick Boyle again. Ignore the part where he continually calls Richard's father Edward. It's Edwin.
Richard was Edward's ne'er-do-well son, whose life up until this point had been not unlike Ponzi's. In the way that Ponzi had flunked out of the University of Rome, Richard had lived similarly while at Harvard. The big difference was that Richard had a deep-pocketed and influential father who was able to fund all of Richard's failures. Edward would write letters to the Dean of Harvard on Boston Post stationery, requesting more and more chances for his son. Under normal circumstances, Richard would have been thrown out of Harvard. He barely attended class and failed to submit papers. He only scraped through and graduated because of the pressure his father put on the college. Richard, at this point, was 10 years out of Harvard and had in no way proved himself.
You might be wondering how in the hell this guy became editor of the Post, and it's a fair question. Edwin got sick, so Richard, who had started working at his dad's paper in various capacities, got a sudden promotion to temporary publisher. He seemed set on doing a good job of it, too. Though he had spent years being a cut-up and a flake, he'd also paid attention to his father's newspaper prowess and knew a good story when he saw one. Tens of thousands of people in Boston headed toward financial disaster? Well, that seemed like a good story to him. Working with the paper's city editor, Edward Dunn, he decided it was the Post's mission to determine if this Ponzi fellow was as above board as he claimed, or if he was the fraud Richard Grosier's gut insisted he must be. The next story the Post ran on Ponzi came the day after the first and included details about a new rival who had set up shop right next door to him. It also included a posed portrait, not of Ponzi, but of his wife and mother, whom he'd paid to have travel to America just weeks earlier, positioned awkwardly in front of the front door of their home. The tone of the writing noticeably shifted from the story just one day earlier. It read, quote, "Federal investigation of Charles Ponzi, head of the securities exchange company whose get-rich-quick proposition, paying 50% in 45 days, is attracting thousands of men, women, and children to entrust him with their savings on no other security than his personal note, is being pushed with vigor," end quote. Ponzi must have sensed his luck was running out. He could have fled, maybe even should have. But he still had a few ideas on business ventures that maybe could turn his bogus one legit, and he still trusted that his considerable charm might keep him out of trouble, even if he didn't go legit. The story on July 26, so 2 days after the fawning feature had run, focused on Ponzi's voluntary pausing of his business. He told District Attorney Joseph Pelletier that he'd happily stop taking any more money from investors to give authorities time to look at his books. For some, this offered assurance that Ponzi was ultra-confident in his business. Others, though, got spooked and asked for their money back, whether it had been 45 days or not. Ponzi abided. He figured the more people he paid back early on, the more that would assuage concerns from people on the fence. He even pulled out a newspaper ad to that effect. Public notice, it read, quote, "I have made a personal agreement with District Attorney Pelletier to cease receiving funds from the public for investment with the Securities Exchange Co., 27 School Street, Boston, and all branches," end quote. It closed by saying that Ponzi would keep paying out his existing investments and also offered to return unmatured notes without interest to anyone who wanted to cut bait and run. The news coverage from that time on was unrelenting. Supposed investors demanded their money back, which Ponzi tried to take in stride. He'd put on a little show for the throngs of people outside his office, even offering them donuts and coffee while they waited. Would a scam artist do that? He seemed to challenge. He paid hundreds of thousands of dollars back to his customers every day. But then came another story. The Boston Post found experts who said there weren't enough international reply coupons in existence to keep Ponzi's scheme afloat, and as such, it was destined to collapse. Granted, that's not what did Ponzi in. He never actually invested in IRCs in the first place. His scheme was bound to collapse for the same reason all the other Rob Peter to pay Paul rackets collapsed. Eventually, you're bound to run out of Peters. Charles Ponzi had started his business in December 1919. By August 1st, 1920, Massachusetts governor and future U.S. president Calvin Coolidge ordered his attorney general to investigate alongside the feds. On August 2nd, the Post ran this headline in huge, bold font across the top of an extra edition. Declares Ponzi is now hopelessly insolvent. It was no ordinary news story. It was actually written by a man whom Ponzi had hired to handle his public relations. William H. McMasters found that his employer had neither received nor sent any money from Europe in recent months, meaning that whatever dough he was using to pay people back didn't come from his IRC scheme. Rather, as one subhead succinctly put it, money in banks taken from investors. By the end of August, multiple people had been arrested, not just in connection with Ponzi's scheme, but also with his competitors, because they too had failed to figure out the magic sauce to make the international reply coupon scheme work. They were doing exactly what Ponzi had done, using new investors' money to pay back earlier investors. Ponzi was charged with 86 counts of mail fraud. He pleaded guilty to just one and got a pretty sweet deal for wreaking havoc on some 40,000 investors' lives. He served 4 years of a 5-year sentence in federal prison. As he was serving that, he and others who had worked alongside him faced a trial on state charges in 1920, of which they were acquitted. After Ponzi's release from federal prison in 1924, he faced a different set of state charges still related to the IRC scheme and was acquitted again. Finally, a third trial found him guilty and sentenced him to 7 to 9 years in prison. It took a while for him to serve that sentence. Ponzi shaved his head and tried to flee, but couldn't resist telling others he encountered what his real name was, and after his release in 1934, was deported to Italy. After a few years, his wife Rose, who had stood by him through everything, said it was time for a divorce because she didn't want to leave Boston and he couldn't join her in America. She still loved him, though, as evidenced by letters the two exchanged over the next 15 years. Ponzi died January 17, 1949, in a hospital's charity ward. He left behind $75, just enough to be buried. Rose remarried after his death and lived until 1993, dying at age 97. The Boston Post demise fell in between. The newspaper at first was bolstered by its Ponzi coverage, winning the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 1921. That was the first time a Boston paper had won the gold in that category, and it wouldn't happen again until the Globe won it in 2003. But as we all know, newspapering has forever been a fickle business. Despite at one point surpassing a circulation of 600,000, the Post fell on hard times in the mid-20th century and finally shuttered in 1956. It was around then, by the way, that the Encyclopedia Britannica formally acknowledged that Ponzi's name had become synonymous with a certain type of swindle. And in that way, Ponzi attained a strange sort of immortality. To research this story, I read Mitchell Zukov's book, Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. I also watched more than one History Channel documentary, plus several others produced by outfits such as Magnates Media, Public School, and Learned Something New. And I read lots and lots of contemporary news stories. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing.